Appendix 3. Terminology. May your path always lead to knowledge, knowledge to freedom. Entropic Litany. Eat the path. Inare. A. Abyssal Conclave, Sycophantic Congress of Renaui Coforms that resides upon the plaintive verge within the oceans of Pelagius. Accuwake, C. Stimware. Adrastea, moon in orbit around the gas giant Zeus in the Sigma Draconis system, in mythology a nymph who cared for the infant Zeus in secret, meaning inescapable in Greek. I go, Korean exclamation used to express many emotions including pity, disgust, frustration, mild discomfort, or surprise, akin to a verbal sigh. Aish, Korean interjection expressing frustration or discontent. Ajuma, Korean term for any middle-aged or older woman, or a married woman even if young. Ajumas are often stereotyped as intense and overbearing. Antimatter farm, large numbers of satellites placed in close orbit around a star. Solar panels convert sunlight into electricity, which is used to generate antimatter. The process is hideously inefficient but necessary, as antimatter is the preferred fuel for Markov drives. Arc arithmetist. See Pontifex Digitalis. ARMS. Semi-autonomous political and sociogenic organizations in Renaui society. Each arm acts as it sees fit, but impulses may be overridden by governing form. See also Tefir. Arecito ahumado, dessert common to San Amaro. Rice pudding flavored with caramel made by boiling dark sugar and filtering the syrup through the ashes of herbs. Aspect of the void. Renaui view screen, traditionally an image generated within an orb of suspended water. B. Battleship, largest standard ship class in the UMC Navy. Heavily armed, able to carry significant numbers of troops, slow to turn given its length. Never operates without support ships. See also cruiser. Beanstalk. See space elevator. Barrel nuts. Edible nuts with gem-like shells used in certain brands of meal packs. Gene-hacked species native to Eidolon. Bits. Cryptocurrency dated to Galactic Standard Time. Most widely accepted form of legal tender across interstellar space. Official currency of the League of Allied Worlds. Black Nova. Cultivar of Capsicum chinensis, gene hacked to deposit pure capsaicin in a waxy outer layer, developed by Innes Tolentira of Stewart's World prior to winning the Tri-Solar Hot Pepper Bash. Blaster, laser that fires a pulse instead of a continuous beam. B. Lumisii, orange lichen-like bacteria native to Adrastea. Boss, generic Hutterite term for a person in charge of any sort of project or organization. Adopted into general usage with numerous variations following the Hutterite expansion. Bug Hunt. UMC name for system formerly settled by the Old Ones, location of the planet humans call Nidus, and final resting place of the Staff of Blue. C. Caretakers. Highly intelligent biomechanical creatures that live on Unity, responsible for general maintenance and minor construction, speculated to have some form of integrated hive mind. Cassava howitzer, nuclear-shaped charge, often mounted on a missile to increase its range. Term can refer to either pure cassava howitzers, which focus a nuclear explosion into a narrow beam of plasma, or cassava howitzers that use said explosion to propel explosively formed projectiles, slugs of molten tungsten with extremely destructive potential. Chell, tea derived from the leaves of the Sheva palm on Eidolon, a mild stimulant used throughout the League. Second in popularity only to coffee, more common among colonists than Terrans. Kiara's Folly, Wayland folk song about the misadventures of a cat. Cloud cities, lightweight, neutral-density habdomes that float in the clouds of Venus, some of the largest and most prosperous settlements outside of Earth. Majority of structural elements come from trees and other plants grown in the domes. Coform, term for Renaui that share the same physical shape. College of Enumerators, governing body of the Numinists at their headquarters on Mars. Compulsion, see Tsuro. Conservation Party, one of several major political parties in the League, ecologically minded with a focus on preserving the flora and fauna of various xenospheres. See also Expansionist Party and Stellarists. Construct: an artificial, though biological, body grown to house the brain of a person who has lost their original flesh, often an intermediate step along the way toward full conversion to ship mind. Cordova, Gliese 785, orange-red dwarf star used by the Renawi as a forward operating base and long-term surveillance post for observing humanity. Corporate citizenship: territory independent citizenship granted to certain employees of interstellar corporations. This allows for individuals to work, travel, and live among different nations, planets, systems with relative ease. Concept developed prior to formation of League and is slowly being superseded by League citizenship, which grants an equivalent passport. Corrupted. See Nightmares. Cruiser: UMC ship designed to operate solo on long-distance surveys and patrols. Smaller and more maneuverable than battleships, but still formidable. Standard gear includes two Markov-equipped shuttles capable of traveling orbit to surface and surface to orbit. Cryo. Cryogenic sleep, suspended animation induced via a cocktail of drugs prior to FTL travel. Cryosickness. Generalized digestive, metabolic, and hormonal distress caused by spending too long in cryo or too many back-to-back trips. Unpleasant to deadly, with side effects scaling to length of time in cryo and/or number of trips. Some individuals are more prone than others. Cycle: Renawi year, roughly a quarter longer than an Earth standard year. D. Delta V: measure of the thrust per unit of mass in a spacecraft needed to perform a certain maneuver. In other words, the change in velocity that can be accomplished by expending the ship's propellant. Maneuvers are measured in the delta V required, and the costs add linearly. The mass of propellant required for any one maneuver is determined via the Tsiolkovsky rocket equation. Department of Defense: civilian department of the League responsible for overseeing the UMC. DERPs: dehydrated excretory recycling pellets, sterile, polymer-coated feces as processed by appropriately equipped skin suits. Director of Interstellar Security: highest civilian intelligence officer in the League. Primary responsibility is the existential protection of humanity. Dakar: Renawi battle formation, typified by an inverted delta shape. E. Earth Central: main League and UMC headquarters, built around the base of the Honolulu beanstalk. Eidolon: planet in orbit around Epsilon Eridani, an Earth-like garden planet teeming with native life, none sentient, and most either poisonous or hostile. The colony there has the highest mortality rate of any settled planet. Entropic Principia: central text of entropism, originated as a statement of intent, later expanded to a philosophical treatise containing a summary of all known scientific knowledge, with primary emphasis on astronomy, physics, and mathematics. See also Entropism. Entropism: stateless pseudo-religion driven by a belief in the heat death of the universe and a desire to escape or postpone said death. Founded by mathematician Jalal Sunyaev Zeldovich in the mid-21st century, entropists devote considerable resources to scientific research and have contributed, directly or indirectly, to numerous important discoveries. Open adherents are noted for their gradient robes. As an organization, entropists have proven difficult to control, as they pledge loyalty to no one government, only to the rigors of their pursuit. Their technology consistently runs several decades ahead of the main of human society, if not more. By our actions, we increase the entropy of the universe. By our entropy, we seek salvation from the coming dark. See also Nova Energium. Enumeration: broadcast of ascending numbers that numinists are required to listen to as part of the observance of their faith. Some numbers, such as primes, are considered more auspicious than others. See also Numinism. Europa Command: League of Allied Worlds Europa Command, LAW EUCOM, shortened EUCOM, is one of seven unified combatant commands of the League military stationed within Sol, headquartered on Lawrence Station, with ongoing material support provided by the manufacturing facilities of Orsed Station by Ganymede. Exoskeleton: exo in common parlance, a powered frame used for combat, freight, mining, and mobility, Exos vary widely in design and function, with some being open to the elements and others hardened for vacuum or the depths of oceans. Armored exos are standard equipment for UMC combat troops. Expansionist Party. One of several major political parties in the League, founded to help foster the spread of humans outside of Sol, now mainly focused on preserving the interests of the established extrasolar colonies, often to the point of blocking the establishment of new ones. See also Conservation Party and Stellarists. Expedition Boss. C. Boss. F. Farsent. Class of durable chemicals secreted by Renawi for long-distance communication in water. Metaphorical bandwidth is narrow and fidelity is low, making this of limited utility for large exchanges of data. See also Nearsent and Low Sound. The Farthest Shore. Spacer poem by Harrow Glancer, Hutterite. Think Noddle's Pious Newt Emporium. Famed amphibian retailer on Earth, established by C.J. Wienis circa 2104. Flash Trace. To travel by FTL far enough that one can stop and see the real-time light from an event, e.g., Spaceship A wants to see when and where Spaceship B left the solar system sometime in the past day. Spaceship A flies the required number of light hours, 24 in this case, from Sol, then sits and watches via telescope until it sees B leaving Sol. Fleet Intelligence. Branch of UMCN devoted to gathering information. Foxglove Pope. See Pontifex Digitalis. Freeholdings. Settlements, conclaves, stations, and outholdings unaffiliated with any major government. FTL. Faster than light. The primary mode of transportation between stars. See also Markov Drive. FTL Tape. Slang for vacuum tape, a type of incredibly tough, pressure-sensitive tape, strong enough to patch breaches in outer hull. Despite popular belief, not suitable for repairs intended to last the duration of FTL trips. Full Sweep. Highest hand in Scratch 7, consisting of 4 sevens, 2 kings, and a 9, for a count of 91 and a score of 13. G. Gecko Pads. Adhesive pads on the bottom of skin suits and boots intended for climbing or maneuvering in 0G. As name implies, pads, which are covered with bristles around 5 micrometers in diameter, depend on van der Waals force for adhesion. Shear force is limiting factor for maximal load, but also provides mechanism for release. Glitter Bug. Small, insect-like animal native to Eidolon. Noted for their brilliant metallic exoskeletons. Glow Lights. Bioluminescent lights grown by the seed. Gradient robes. Traditional garb of observing entropists, adorned with the rising phoenix that is their sigil. Metamaterial laced with advanced technology that allows the robes to act as a skin suit, armor, and when needed, a weapon. Great Beacon. First alien artifact found by humans, located at Talus 7, Theta Persei 2. The beacon is a hole 50 kilometers wide and 30 deep. It emits an EMP at 304 megahertz every 10.6 seconds, along with a burst of structured sound that is a representation of the Mandelbrot set in trinary code. Surrounded by a net of vanadium-laced gallium that may have once acted as a superconductor, giant turtle-like creatures, without heads or legs, roam the plains surrounding the hole. As of yet, no one has discovered their relationship with the artifact. 6 more beacons are known to exist. They are assumed to have been constructed by the old ones, but definitive proof is lacking. Intended purpose remains a mystery. Ground Pounder. Derogatory term for one who lives on or was born on a planet. GST. Galactic Standard Time. Universal chronology as determined by emissions of TEQs from the galactic core. Causality may appear to be broken, but only appear. A must always cause B. H. Hanzo Tensegrity. Insurance company based out of Seoul, not known for their customer satisfaction. Hatching pools. Shallow tidal pools where Renawi would hatch their eggs, now replicated in artificial pools for travel and convenience. Upon hatching, young Renawi are combative and cannibalistic. Only the strongest few survive. Hadawari. Large saltwater carnivore native to Pelagius, one of only a few predators known to prey upon adult Renawi. Closely related to Renawi, but less intelligent. Heptarchy. Ruling Council of the Old Ones. See also, hindmost. Heresy of the flesh. See to fear. Hibernaculum. Entropous term for a cryotube. High Lafar. A famed prominence on Pelagius. Temperate weather made it a favorite location for Renaui hatching pools. Later acquired enormous sociopolitical and religious significance with the discovery of several artifacts of the old ones built upon it. Original site of the Renaui conclave, later the Abyssal Conclave, prior to the joining of the arms and the ascendancy of the regnant form. Hymost, wielder of the Staff of Blue, leader of the Heptarchy. Hive mind, psychomechanical joining of two or more brains, usually accomplished by continual beam synchronization of subject implants, ensuring agreement between intero, extero, and proprioceptive stimuli. Total exchange of prior sense memory is a common, though not required, part of establishing a hive mind. Effective range depends on signaling bandwidth and tolerance for lag. Breakdown tends to occur when physical proximity exceeds tolerance. Largest recorded hive mind was 49, but experiment was short-lived as participants experienced debilitating sensory overload. Hunter-seeker. Small drones used for surveillance and assassination. Hutterite expansion. Series of intensive colonization efforts by reform Hutterites, starting in the solar system and expanding outward following the discovery of FTL. The period is said to begin shortly after the construction of Earth's first space elevator and end with the settlement of Eidolon. See also, reform Hutterites. Hydrotech Corp. Company specializing in hydrogen extraction and refinement around gas giants. Hydrotech stations are the main refueling and remassing facilities in most systems. Idealis. As the seed is able to change shape, form, at will, the Renaui consider it the platonic ideal of physical embodiment. Inare. Invalid input, entry not found. IPD. Interplanetary diploma. Only educational degree accepted throughout all of settled space. Accreditation is overseen by Bao University on Stewart's World, in cooperation with several schools in Seoul. IPDs cover most relevant subjects, including law, medicine, and all the major sciences. ITC, Interstellar Trade Commission, a department of the League tasked with overseeing interstellar commerce. Its remit includes enforcing standards, collecting tariffs, and fraud prevention, as well as providing loans and resources to spur economic growth throughout settled space. J. Jellies. C. Renaui. K. Knot of Minds. In general, any group of Renaui bound and dedicated to a singular purpose, a solemn and sacred joining, traditionally sealed by winding one's tentacles, limbs, around those of the other bondees. As such, a knot often only has 7 members, that being the number of primary tentacles the main Renaui form has, but the concept is often expanded to include more. In the modern era, a knot can be formed over low-sound near-scent, but there is a bias against those knots as being less binding than those formed in person. Specifically, the knot founded by Shoal leader Namarl and its compatriots with the purpose of opposing Katane's leadership and safeguarding the Idealis later bonded with Kira Navarez. Lamp lines. Seaweed-like growths that provide illumination in the depths of the plaintive verge. Lapsang Trading Corporation. Interstellar conglomerate that began as a mercantile venture before shifting into founding, funding, and running colonies such as Highstone on Wayland, headquartered on Stewart's World. Slogan, Forging the Future Together. League of Allied Worlds, Law. Interstellar government formed after the discovery of the Great Beacon on Talos 7, consists of the settlements in and around Sol, Alpha Centauri, Epsilon Indi, Epsilon Eridani, and 61 Cygni. Lion clam. Animal native to Eidolon, noted for its amber shell, used in the manufacture of a sepia-colored ink. Loaderbot. Semi-autonomous robots used for manual labor. Low sound. Vocal emanations used by Renaui for communication over long distances in their oceans, similar to whale song. Low sound far scent. Traditionally a combination of the two methods Renaui use for long-distance communication in water, more commonly a term for STL or FTL transmissions, such as radio. Lutsenko Defense Industries, a Ruslan-based munitions company. M. Machine Boss. C. Boss. Mag Shield, Either the magnetospheric dipolar torus of ionized plasma used to protect spaceships from solar radiation during interplanetary trips, or the magneto-hydrodynamic system used for braking and thermal protection during re-entry. Meniform. See seed. Markov bubble, sphere of subluminal space permeated with a conditioned EM field that allows for tardionic matter to transition through the membrane of fluidic spacetime into superluminal space. Markov drive. Antimatter-fueled machine that allows for FTL travel. See also unified field theory. Markov, Ilya. Engineer and physicist who outlined the unified field theory in 2107, thus allowing for modern FTL travel. Markov limit. Distance from a gravitational mass at which it becomes possible to sustain a Markov bubble, and thus transition to FTL travel. Metabot. Robotic assistant capable of diagnosis and treatment for all but the most difficult cases. Doctors rely on Metabots for the majority of surgeries. Many ships forego a doctor entirely, prioritizing cost savings over the relatively small risk of needing a human physician. Metafoam. Sterile, antibiotic-laced foam that hardens into a semi-flexible cast, used to stop bleeding, immobilize fractures, and when injected into bodily cavities, prevent infection. MILCOM. Official UMC Communication Network. N. Nanoassembler. 3D printer that utilizes nanobots to produce complex shapes, machines, and, given the appropriate stock, biological structures such as muscles, organs, and seeds. Nauru class. Medium-mass Ranaui ships that carry a limited number of troops, usually no more than 3 squids, 2 or 3 crawlers, and the same number of snappers. Nearsent. Chemicals secreted by Ranaui for communication, their primary method of conveying linguistic and non-linguistic information. Nest of transference. Ranaui device for copying memories and basic brain structures from one body to another. Also used to imprint stored personalities, memories, onto a new body after the original individual dies. See also, to fear. Nightmares. Malignant, self-sustaining growths caused by an unsuccessful joining between seed and host, usually when either seed or host, or both, are damaged beyond proper repair. Nanar. Coral-like organism native to Pelagius, commonly used as a decorative element by the Ranaui. Some varieties secrete a clear coating that has mild psychotropic effects on the immature forms of the Ranaui. Nomati. Polyp-like animals native to the Arctic regions of Eidolon. Every solar eclipse they detach from their anchor point, usually a rock, and hop 14 times. Reason as yet unknown. Noradon. Fast-acting liquid analgesic suitable for mid-level to severe pain. Nova Energium. The headquarters and prime research lab of the Entropists, located near Shinzar. Nisaro. Ranaui measurement of length, defined as the distance one can swim in 7 pulses. See also cycle and pulse. Number supreme. Largest number imaginable, as defined by the numinists, the sum of all knowledge, containing the known and the unknown, the greater part of 2 equal halves, God. Numinism. Religion centered around the supposed holy nature of numbers, founded on Mars by Sal Horker II circa 2165 to 2179, estimated. Numinism quickly gained traction among colonists and workers dependent upon the technology of their new world for survival. Defining feature of Numinism is the ongoing broadcast of numbers, the enumeration, from their headquarters on Mars. The enumeration is working its way in ascending order through the list of real numbers. Numinous flange. Enormous geological structure on Ruslan. Uplifted granite slab laced with gold veins, prominent tourist feature on Ruslan, known to inspire religious fervor and existential crises among viewers. Setting of Adeline, an influential drama whose lead actor Sasha Petrovich was involved in a corruption scandal near the end of 2249, which led to the resignation of Ruslan's governor, Maxim Novikov, and the appointment of Inquisitor Orlov to resolve the situation. Subsequent unrest continued on and off for several years. Nawar. Many-legged saltwater animal native to Pelagius, has crustacean-like shell and omnivorous diet, noted for its solitary habits. O. Old ones. Sentient race responsible for making the seed, the great beacons, and numerous other technological artifacts found throughout the Orion arm of the Milky Way. humanoid, with two sets of arms. They stood about 2 meters tall, seemingly extinct. Evidence shows their species was extraordinarily advanced and predates every other known self-aware species. See also Hymost and Staff of Blue. Orbital ring. Large artificial ring placed around a planet. Can be built at nearly any distance, but first ring is usually built in low orbit. Basic concept is simple. Rotating cable orbits equator. A non-orbiting superconducting shell encases said cable. The shell is used to accelerate-decelerate cable as needed. Solar panels and structures can be constructed on outer shell, including stationary space elevators. Gravity on outer ring of shell ring is near planetary levels, a cheap and practical way to move large amounts of mass in and out of orbit, used by both humans and Ranawi. Orb of conversion. Ranawi FTL drive. It converts a ship from STL space to FTL space. Oros fern. Plant native to Eidolon, green-black with leaves that grow from a coiled shape similar to fiddleheads, thus the name. P. Packet. Small, unmanned FTL-capable messenger drone. Pattern. Embedded directive that guides and sets the long-term goals of the seed. PDF. Planetary Defense Force, local military, often civilian, attached to a certain planet. Pelagius. Human name for the Ranawi homeworld, F-type star, 340 light-years from Sol. Fennec. Fish-like animal native to Pelagius, noted for copper taste of its meat, common delicacy among the Ranawi. Plaintive verge. Underwater volcanic vent in the oceans of Pelagius, home of the abyssal conclave. Ponder Union. Workers' union based out of the Ceres shipyards. Pontifex Digitalis. Nominal religious head of the Numinists, commands and answers to the College of Enumerators, responsible for overseeing the enumeration of real numbers. Premier. Head of the League of Allied Worlds, elected by the constituent governments. Prisoner. Anyone not an entropist. One imprisoned within the dying universe by their lack of knowledge. Pseudo-intelligence. Convincing simulacrum of sentience. True artificial intelligence has thus far proved more difficult and dangerous to create than anticipated. Pseudo-intelligence are programs capable of limited executive function, but lack self-awareness, creativity, and introspection. Despite their limitations, they've proven immensely helpful in nearly every realm of human endeavor, from piloting ships to managing cities. See also Ship Mind. Pulse. Standard unit of Ranawi timekeeping, equivalent to 42 seconds. See also Cycle. Q. Q drive. A quantum level memory stick. Questant. An entropist. One who quests for a way to save humanity from the heat death of the universe. R. RD-52s. Hydrogen-cooled cassava howitzers chilled to within a fraction of a degree of absolute zero, used as mines, an early attempt at stealth weaponry in space. Reform Hutterites. Heretical offshoot of traditional ethno-religious Hutterism, now far outnumbering their forebears. Reform Hutterites, RHs, accept the use of modern technology where it allows them to further pursue the spread of humanity and establish their claim over God's creation, but they frown on any use of tech such as stem shots for what they deem selfish individual needs. Where possible, they hew to communal-based life. They have proven highly successful everywhere they've settled. Unlike traditional Hutterites, RHs are known to serve in the military, although this is still frowned upon by the majority of their society. Reginald the Pig-Headed God. Local cult leader in the city of Koiso. Gene-hacked human with a head in the shape of a pig's, believed by his followers to be a deity in flesh and possessed of supernatural powers. Remas. Propellant expelled out the back of a spaceship, usually hydrogen, not to be confused with fuel, which in the case of nuclear rockets is the material fused or split to heat the remas propellant. Reticulum. Intra-ship network used by Ranawi. Ripple. Invalid input, entry not found. RM. Reserve mark. Indicates legal protection over a term, phrase, or symbol. Rods. C.S. jams. RSW-7 Molotok. Cassava howitzers manufactured by Lutsenko Defense Industries. RTC News. Ruslan Transmission Company, Newsfeed out of 61 Cygni. Ruslan, rocky planet in orbit around 61 Cygni A, second newest colony in the league behind Wayland. Primarily settled by Russian interests, extensive mining takes place in the asteroid belts around A's binary partner, Cygni B. S. Saman Sahari, low, slow song originating from Farson's Combine, a collectivist freehold established on a planetoid around Alpha Centauri during the early years of the system's colonization. San Amaro, small Latin American country. Location of Earth's first space elevator. Saya. To be sure. Direct translation is closer to my surety. Common usage on Ruslan, derived from Malay. Scourge. Microbe that killed 27 of 34 humans sent to survey the rocky planetoid Blackstone. Scramrock. Post-fusion hypervibes, typified by samples of radio and plasma waves taken from the rings of various gas giants, popularized by honeysuckle heaps in 2232. Scratch 7. Traditional spacer card game. Goal is to accumulate as many sevens or multiples of seven as possible by adding values of cards. Face cards go by their numerical value. Secretary of Defense. Civilian official who oversees the League military. Seed. Self-organizing genetic potential. A spark of life in the endless void. Seeker. Servitor life form created by the Old Ones with the intent of enforcement and containment. Able to assume direct control over a living creature's actions following physical contact and injections into brain case. Highly intelligent, highly dangerous, and known to amass large armies of enslaved sentients. 7 minutes to Saturn. War movie made at Alpha Centauri in 2242 about Venus's failed attempt to win independence from Earth during the Zaan offensive. Seventh Fleet. Numbered fleet of the League of Allied Worlds, headquartered at Deimos Station by Mars. Part of the UMC Solar Fleet, largest of the forward-deployed UMC fleets. Safar. Renawi clearance level. Higher than Safen, lower than Safir. Shadow Shield. A plug of radiation shielding that sits between a reactor and the main body of a spaceship, comprising two layers, neutron shielding, usually lithium hydroxide, and gamma ray shielding, either tungsten or mercury. In order to keep stations and crew within the shadow cast by the shield, spaceships usually dock nose first. Shell. Renawi word for spaceship, derived from their own protective carapaces. Shibal. Korean profanity, equivalent to English fuck, exclusively used with anger and or negative connotation. Shinzar. High G planet in orbit around Tau Ceti, only major colony to refuse membership to the League, which resulted in armed conflict between Zarian forces and the League, at the loss of some thousands of lives on both sides. Notable for the high number of colonists of Korean descent, also notable for population-wide gene hacking in order to help the colonists adapt to the stronger-than-Earth gravity. Main alterations being significantly thicker skeletal structure, increased lung capacity to compensate for low oxygen levels, increased hemoglobin, increased muscular mass via myostatin inhibition, doubled tendons, and generally larger organs. Divergent genetic population. See also entropism. Shipcat. Traditional pet aboard spaceships. Superstitious belief attaches great importance to the presence and well-being of a shipcat. Plenty of spacers will refuse to sign onto a vessel without one. More than one instance has been recorded of someone being killed after harming, intentionally or otherwise, a shipcat. Shipmind. The somatic transcendence of humanity. Brains removed from bodies, placed in a growth matrix, and bathed with nutrients to induce tissue expansion and synaptic formation. Shipminds are the result of a confluence of factors. Human desire to push their intellect to the limit, the failure to develop true AI, the increasing size of spaceships, and the destructive potential of any spacefaring vessel. Having a single person, a single mind, to oversee the many operations of a ship was appealing. However, no unaugmented brain was capable of handling the large amount of sensory information a full-sized spaceship produced. The larger the vessel, the larger the brain needed. Ship minds are some of the most brilliant individuals humanity has produced, also, in cases, some of the most disturbed. The growth process is difficult, and severe psychiatric side effects have been noted. It is theorized that ship minds, both on and off ships, are responsible for directing far more of the daily affairs of humans than any but the most paranoid suspect. But while their means and methods may sometimes be opaque, their desires are no different than those of any other living creature: to live long and prosper. Shoal leader. Any Renawi captain or commander in charge of more than 3 units, but usually reserved for leaders of equivalent rank to brigadier or admiral. SJAMs, aka rods from God, inert projectiles made of tungsten rods that are dropped from orbit, concept invented by Dr. Purnell in the 20th century, a form of kinetic weapon, used by militaries when conventional explosives are impractical, as when wanting to avoid radiation, or when anti-projectile countermeasures are a concern. Skin suit. General-purpose skin-tight protective clothing that, with a helmet, can act as a spacesuit, diving equipment, and cold-weather gear. Standard equipment for anyone in a hostile environment. Scut. Grimy, useless, as in, go do that scut work. Derived from scut, pejorative. Slaver monk. See seeker. SLV. Superluminal vehicle. League designation for a civilian vessel capable of FTL. Smart fabric. Metamaterial embedded with electronics, nanomachines, and other augments, able to assume different shapes given the proper stimuli. SPAC. Robotic manipulator used for handling material in quarantine. Space elevator. Carbon fiber ribbon that extends from the surface of a planet all the way to an anchor point, usually an asteroid, out past geostationary orbit. Crawlers transport mass up and down the ribbon. Spacer's tan. Inevitable result of spending days and months under the full spectrum lights used in spaceships to avoid seasonal affective disorder, vitamin D deficiency, and a host of other ailments, especially notable in native station dwellers and lifelong ship inhabitants. Staff of Blue. Command module constructed by the old ones, of great socio-technological significance. Staff of Green. Fragment of the seed, given life unto itself. Stellarists. One of several major political parties in the League, currently the governing party, isolationist movement composed of the main governmental powers on Mars, Venus, and Earth, gained traction following the troubles with Shinzar and the discovery of the Great Beacon. See also Conservation Party and Expansionist Party. Stellar Security Act. Legislation passed upon the formation of the League of Worlds that resulted in the formation of the UMC and that grants sweeping powers to the military, intelligence services, and civilian leadership in the event of an exogenic incident, such as the discovery of the Softblade. Stem shots. Series of anti-senescent injections that revitalize cellular processes, suppress mutagenic factors, restore telomere length, and generally return the body to a state equivalent to mid-20s biological age, usually repeated every 20 years thereafter, doesn't stop age-induced cartilage growth in ears, nose, etc. Stewart's World. Rocky planet in orbit around Alpha Centauri. First settled world outside of Sol, discovered and named by Ort Stewart. Not a hospitable place, and as a result, the settlers produce a higher than normal proportion of scientists, their expertise being needed to survive the harsh environment. Also why so many spacers come from Stewart's World, they're eager to find somewhere more temperate. Stimware. One of several brands of a popular sleep replacement medication. The drug contains two different compounds, one to reset the body's circadian rhythm, and one to clear the brain of metabolites such as beta amyloid. When sleep-deprived, dosage prevents neurodegeneration and maintains high-level mental, physical functioning. Anabolic state of sleep is not replicated, so normal rest is still needed for secretion of growth hormone and proper recovery from daily stresses. Straight sweep. Highest natural hand in Scratch 7, consisting of 4 kings, 2 queens, and an ace, for a count of 77 and a score of 11. Strike Shoal Hafar. Named fleet within the Renawi military, there being one for each arm. Sundering. Cataclysmic Renawi civil war, sparked by the discovery of numerous technological artifacts made by the old ones, including the seed and several other forms like it. This led to the Tafir's heresy of the flesh. While arm fought arm for supremacy, the Renawi also engaged in an ambitious expansionist campaign, colonizing numerous systems. Their internal conflict nearly destroyed their species, partly through conventional warfare, partly through the awakening of a seeker, and partly through the inadvertent creation of corrupted, Renawi civilization was shattered, and it took nearly 3 centuries to fully recover. See also Ripple and Tafir. T. Tungagria. Folk song from Bologna, Italy, composer unknown. TEQ. See Transluminal Energy Quantum. Tesserite. Mineral unique to Adrastea, similar to benatoite, but with a greater tendency toward purple. Tafir. One of 6 arms of the Renawi, noted for its heresy of the flesh, self-replication via the nest of transference without the death of one's original form, considered a sin of pride by the rest of the Renawi, a major contributing factor to the sundering. Thresh. Hardcore smasher metal that originated in the farming communities of Eidolon, noted for use of agricultural implements as instruments. Thule, a.k.a. the Lord of Empty Spaces, pronounced Thule, God of the Spacers, derived from Ultima Thule, Latin phrase used to mean a place beyond the borders of all maps. Originally applied to a trans-Neptunian planetesimal in Sol, the term came to be applied to the unknown in general, and from thence gained personification. Extensive superstitions surround Thule among the asteroid miners in Sol and elsewhere. Tiger Maul. Large feline-esque predator native to Eidolon, noted for the barbs on its back, yellow eyes, and high intelligence. Torque engine. Generator and propulsive engine devised by the Old Ones, used to power Unity as well as drive spaceships of the Old Ones' design, works by torquing the membrane of fluidic spacetime in such a way as to allow the extraction of energy from superluminal space, despite the lower energy density of that space. The distortion can also be used to propel the engine through subluminal space via warping, or to form a Markov bubble for FTL travel. Torque gate. Artificial wormhole generated and sustained by a torque engine stationed at either mouth, used by the Old Ones for near instantaneous travel over vast distances. Taxopaxia. Popular jig from one of the hab rings around Sol. Transcendence. Computer game where the goal is to guide a species from the dawn of sentience to colonizing nearby stars in as short a time as possible. Transluminal Energy Quantum, TEQ. The most fundamental building block of reality, a quantized entity of Planck length 1, Planck energy 1, and 0 mass, occupies every point of space, both sub- and superluminal as well as within the luminal membrane that divides the two. Tesuro. Signaling device used by the Old Ones for summoning and controlling the seed, accomplished via a modulated TEQ wavefront. 28G. One of several commsats in orbit around Zeus and Adrastea. U. UUMC, United Military Command. Combined military forces of the League drawn from the constituent members. Numerous of those governments have ceased maintaining their own militaries and instead direct all their defense resources to the UMC. UMCA, United Military Command Army. UMCI, United Military Command Intelligence. UMCM, United Military Command Marines. UMCN, United Military Command Navy. UMCS, United Military Command Ship, Station. Unified Field Theory. Theory outlined by Ilya Markov in 2107 that provides the underpinnings for FTL travel, as well as numerous other technologies. V. Vanished. See Old Ones. W. Wayland. Colony planet in orbit around Epsilon Indi, named after the Nordic Germanic Smith of legend, no notable native life forms. Whirlpool. See Great Beacon. Wirescan. An in-depth invasive review of all the data gathered by a person's implants, often damaging to the physical and mental health of the subject, given the strength of the electrical signals used as well as the intimate nature of the probe, sometimes results in loss of brain function. Renawi. Sentient spacefaring race originating from the planet Pelagius, highly complex life cycle with an equally complicated hierarchical social structure dominated by arms and a ruling form. Renawi are naturally an ocean-based species, but through extensive use of artificial bodies have adapted themselves to nearly every possible environment. Aggressive and expansionist, they have little regard for individual rights or safety, given their reliance on replacement bodies. Their scent-based language is exceedingly difficult for humans to translate. Even without technological augmentation, Rinnawi are biologically immortal. Their genetic-based bodies are always able to revert to an immature form in order to renew their flesh and stave off senescence. Some evidence indicates they may have been genetically modified by the old ones at some point in their distant past. Why? Yanni the Newt. Children's entertainment show popular on Ruslan that led to a fad for owning pet newts. Appendix 4. Timeline. 1700 to 1800, estimated. The Sundering. 2025 to 2054. Development and construction of Earth's first space elevator, quickly followed by increased exploration and economic development within the solar system, Sol. First humans land on Mars. Moon base built, as well as several space stations throughout Sol. Asteroid mining starts. 2054 to 2104. With the space elevator up, colonization of the solar system accelerates. Hutterite expansion begins. First floating city on Venus established. Permanent, although not self-sustaining, outposts on Mars. Many more habitats and stations built throughout the system. Construction begins on an orbital ring around Earth. Fission-powered nuclear thermal rockets are the primary mode of transportation in solar system. Mathematician Jalal Sunyaev-Zeldovich publishes founding precepts of entropism. Law enforcement becomes increasingly difficult throughout the solar system. Clashes start between the outer settlements and the inner planets. International space law is increased and further developed by the UN and individual governments. Militias spring up on Mars and among the asteroid miners. Space-based corporations use private security firms to safeguard their investments. Space is fully militarized at this point. Venus and Mars remain tightly tied to Earth, politically and resource-wise, but independence movements begin to form. Giant solar arrays built in space provide cheap power throughout Sol. Overlays, implants, and genetic modification are common among those who can afford them. Powerful fusion drives replace older fission rockets, drastically reducing travel times within the solar system. 2104 to 2154. Think Noddle's Pious Newt Emporium established. Stem shots are invented, effectively rendering humans biologically immortal. This leads to the launch of several self-sustaining sublight colony ships to Alpha Centauri. Soon after, Ilya Markov codifies the Unified Field Theory, UFT. Working prototype of an FTL drive constructed in 2114. Experimental vessel Daedalus makes first FTL flight. FTL ships depart for Alpha Centauri, overtaking sublight colony ships. First extrasolar colony is founded on Stewart's World at Alpha Centauri. OALERT 2122 confirms that the majority of local superluminal matter exists in a vast halo around the Milky Way. Several more extrasolar colonies follow, first on Shinzar, then on Eidolon. Some of the city's outposts are funded by corporations, some by nations back on Earth. Either way, colonies are highly dependent on supplies from Sol to begin with, and most of the colonists end up deep in debt after buying the various pieces of equipment they need. 2154 to 2230. Wayland colonized. Numenism founded on Mars by Sal Horker II circa 2165 to 2179, estimated. As they grow, colonies begin to assert their independence from Earth and Sol. Clashes between local factions, e.g. the unrest on Shinzar. Relations with Earth grow fractious. Venus tries and fails to win its independence in the Zaan offensive. Ruslan colonized. 2230. Kira Navarez is born. 2234 to 2237. Discovery of the Great Beacon on Talos 7 by Captain Idris and the crew of the SLV Adamura. The League of Allied Worlds is formed, with much resistance and suspicion. Some colonies, freeholdings, abstain. Passage of the Stellar Security Act, leading to the creation of the UMC and consolidation of much of humanity's forces. Battles of sovereignty occur with several groups that insist upon remaining independent, including, most notably, the planetary government of Shinzar. Severe winter storm on Wayland results in significant damage to the Navarez family greenhouses. 2237 to 2257. Corruption scandal with Sasha Petrovich near the end of 2249 results in the resignation of Ruslan's governor, Maxim Novikov. 2257 to 58. survey of the moon Adrastea, and subsequent events.
Afterword and acknowledgements. 1. Greetings, friends. It's been a long journey. Come in, have a seat by the hollow, take the weight off your feet. You must be tired. There's some Venusian scotch on the shelf to your side. Yes, that's it. Pour yourself a glass if you want. While you recover, let me tell you a story. No, not that one. Another. One that begins all the way back in 2006, 2007. The dates grow vague with time. I had finished my second novel, Eldest, and was nearly done with the third, Brisinger. And I was straining at the bit, frustrated that what had once been a trilogy had expanded into a tetralogy, and that I would have to spend several more years working on the inheritance cycle. Mind you, I loved the series and was happy to finish it. But at the same time, I wanted, no, I needed to try my hand at something else. Discipline is a necessary prerequisite to creative success, and yet the value of variety should not be dismissed. By trying new things, we learn and grow and maintain excitement for our craft. So, while I spent my days in the land of Alagazia, writing about elves and dwarves and dragons, I spent my nights dreaming about other adventures in other places. And one of those dreams involved a woman who found an alien biosuit on a moon orbiting a gas giant. It was a rough idea, more of a sketch than anything. But even from the very beginning, I always knew how the story would start, with Kira finding the suit, and how it would end, with her drifting off into space. The difficult bit was figuring out all the parts in between. After finishing Brisinger, I took a stab at writing the beginning of To Sleep in a Sea of Stars. If you saw that early version, you would laugh. It was half-baked, underformed, but the bones of what would become this story were still there, waiting to be unearthed. I had to put it aside to write and promote Inheritance. That took me until mid-2012. Touring for a popular book/series is no small thing. And after that, after finishing a series I'd been working on from the age of 15 to 28, I needed a break. For 6 months, I didn't write. Then the old itch to create took over. I knocked out a screenplay, which didn't work. I wrote a number of short stories, one of which was later published in The Fork, the Witch, and the Worm, a sequel to The Inheritance Cycle. And I began to research the scientific underpinnings to my future history. That research occupied most of 2013. I'm not a physicist, nor a mathematician. I never even went to college. So I had to put in a lot of work to reach the level of understanding I wanted. Why go to such lengths? Because as magic is to fantasy, science is to, well, science fiction. It sets the rules to your story, defines what is or isn't possible. And although I envisioned To Sleep as a love letter to the genre, I wanted to avoid certain technical conventions that would undermine the setting. Mainly, I wanted a way for ships to travel FTL that didn't allow for time travel and that didn't blatantly contradict physics as we know it. I was okay with bending a few rules here and there, but outright breakage didn't sit right with me. Of course, all the world building in the universe doesn't matter if the story itself isn't sound. And that, I'm afraid, is where I met my greatest difficulty. For various personal reasons, writing the first draft of To Sleep took until January of 2016. 3-ish years of hard, hard work. Upon finishing, my first reader, my one and only sister, Angela, informed me that the book just didn't work. Upon reading the manuscript myself, I realized that she was, unfortunately, correct. 2017 passed in a frenzy of rewrites, none of which fixed the underlying issues. The rewrites were, to put it metaphorically, like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, which did nothing to change the fact that the ship's structural integrity was compromised. The problem was this. After working on the inheritance cycle for so long, my plotting skills had gotten rusty from disuse. The problem-solving muscles I had built while developing the story for Aragon and sequels had atrophied in the decades since. And I won't lie. After the success of the inheritance cycle, I had, perhaps, been a bit cocky when starting to sleep. Well, if I could do that, surely this won't be a problem. Ha! Life, fate, the gods, call it what you will, but reality has a way of humbling us all. The situation came to a head at the end of 2017 when my agent, Simon, and then-editor Michelle, gently informed me that the rewrites just weren't cutting it. At that moment, I nearly gave up. After so much work and time invested, to be back at nearly square one was demoralizing. But if I have a defining trait, it's determination. I really hate to give up on a project, even when common sense tells me otherwise. So in November 2017, I stopped rearranging the deck chairs and instead went back to the basic blueprint of the story. And I questioned everything. In a week and a half, I wrote, by hand, over 200 pages of notes dissecting character, motivation, meaning, symbology, technology. You name it, I looked at it. And only then, only once I felt I had a new and stronger skeleton to hang this story upon, did I start writing again. Most of Part 1, Exogenesis, remained the same, and some of Part 2, but everything after that, I wrote from scratch. There was no bug hunt in the original version of To Sleep, no visit to Sol, no trip to Cordova, no nightmares, no Maw, no Unity, no grand adventure beyond 61 Cygni. In essence, I wrote an entirely new book, and not a small one, over the course of 2018 and the first half of 2019. During the same time, I also wrote and edited The Fork, The Witch, and The Worm, toured for it in the US and Europe, and continued to tour the US for the entirety of 2019 as Barnes & Noble's writer-in-residence. Whew. Writing and editing To Sleep has been by far the hardest creative challenge of my life. I had to relearn how to tell a story, rewrite a book I'd been laboring on for years, and overcome a number of personal and professional challenges. Was it worth it? I think so. And I'm looking forward to putting the skills I've learned / reacquired to use on a new book. One that, if all goes well, will take substantially less than 9 years to write and publish. In looking back over the history of this project, it feels in no small part like a dream. So much time has passed. So much angst and effort and ambition. I finished the first draft while spending the winter split between a dingy apartment in Edinburgh and a slightly brighter apartment in Barcelona. Revisions were carried out where I live in Montana, but also at a dozen different locations across the globe as work and life took me about. The final edits were carried out during a pandemic. When I first got the idea for To Sleep, I was in my mid-20s. Now, I'm in the latter half of my 30s. When I started, there was no white in my beard. Hell, I didn't even have a beard. Now, the first streaks of frost have appeared. I've even gotten married. And that's been an adventure all its own. To Sleep in a Sea of Stars isn't perfect, but it's the best version of this story I could write, and I'm proud of the final result. To quote Rolf Humphreys from the foreword to his translation of the Aeneid, "The scope of an epic requires, in the writing, a designed variety, a calculated unevenness, now and then some easygoing carelessness." All very true. I'm also fond of what he says further on. "The last revisions are always the most enervating, and Virgil, one can well believe, having worked on the poem for over a decade, had reached the point where he felt he would rather do anything, including die, than go over the poem one more time. Who wants an epic poem absolutely perfect anyway?" My sentiments exactly. Nevertheless, I hope you enjoy the imperfections of this novel. So, now I've told a story about a story. The night grows late, and your Venusian scotch is nearly gone. I've spent long enough rambling on, but before you retire, a few final points. 1. Those of you who are fans of The Inheritance Cycle may have noticed some references to the series Into Sleep. You weren't imagining things. And yes, Inara is who you think she is. For those unfamiliar with that name, I recommend looking up Jode's letter on my website, paolini.net. 2. If you wish to dig deeper into the universe of To Sleep, I suggest paying attention to the use of the number 7 in the story. Where possible, all numbers are either multiples of 7, or maybe added up to equal 7. You may also find it interesting to locate places outside this novel where 7 might be input. 3. The table of contents contains some acrostic fun. Enough. I've said my fill. The air is cold, the stars are bright, and this tale has reached its end, both for Kira and for me. Eat the path. 2. In creating this novel, I was fortunate to have the support of an enormous number of people. Without them, To Sleep would never have seen the light of day. They are my dad, for keeping things running when I was buried in the manuscript for months on end. My mom, for patience and editing, so much editing, and continual support. My sister, Angela, for never letting me settle for second best, and for giving me the kick in the pants needed to fix Grigorovich's storyline, among many others. Karu, who created the awesome logos, aside from Shinzar's, that appear in the terminology section, as well as tons of other concept art. My wife, Ash, for her ongoing support, humor, love, and various artistic contributions, including the logo for Shinzar. And a big thank you to my whole family for reading this book more times than any sane person ought to. My assistant and friend, Emanuela Meyer, for her input, support, and some gorgeous pieces of artwork. She's the one responsible for the map of Sigma Draconis, 61 Cygni, part of Bug Hunt, and the really awesome fractal endpaper slash map. My agent, Simon Lipscar, who from the very beginning has been a tireless champion of this book and what he knew it could be. Thank you, Simon. My dear friend, Michelle Fry, who read several early versions of the book and who had the unenviable task of telling me that they weren't working. Without her input, I never would have taken the leap and written a version that did work. At Macmillan, Don Weisberg, who knew me during his time at Random House, and because of it, was willing to take a chance on an adult novel from someone previously only known for YA. Thank you, Don. At Tor, my editors, Davy Pillay and William Hinton. They pushed me far harder than I expected, and the book is better because of it. Also in editorial, assistants Rachel Bass and Oliver Doherty, and copy editor Christina McDonald. In publicity / marketing, Lucille Retino, Eileen Lawrence, Stephanie Sarabin, Caroline Perney, Sarah Reedy, and Renata Sweeney. If you've heard of this book, they're the ones responsible. In design / production, Michelle Foytek, Greg Collins, Peter Lutyen, Jim Kapp, Raphael Gibbick. Without them, the book wouldn't have been published on time, and it sure wouldn't have looked as good. And thanks to everyone else at Tor who has worked on this book. Also thanks to Lindy Martin for the gorgeous cover image. On the technical side of things, Gregory Mahalik, who was kind enough to let me use his tri-space theory as the basis for my FTL system. He also answered scores and scores of questions as I struggled to understand the specifics of how it worked. Apologies to him for bastardizing his theory in one or two places in the interests of fiction. Sorry, Greg. Also Richard Gautier, who originated the idea of TEQs, and H. David Froning Jr., who invented the technical groundwork for conditioned EM fields, which I used as the basis for my Markov drives. And last but not least, Winchell Chung and the Atomic Rockets website, www.projectrho.com/rocket. The best resource for anyone wanting to write realistic science fiction. Without it, the ideas in this book would have been far less interesting. A special mention goes to the family of Felix Hofer, who were kind enough to let me use his name in this book. Felix was a reader of mine who, tragically, was killed in a motorcycle accident soon after his 18th birthday. We'd had some correspondence and, well, I wanted to mark his passing and do my best to help Felix's name live on. As always, the biggest thanks of all go to you, dear reader. Without you, none of this would be possible. So again, thank you. Let's do it again soon. Christopher Paolini, September 15th, 2020. Hi, everyone. This is Christopher Paolini, and I am here talking with none other than the awesome Jennifer Hale.
This is Jennifer Hale, and I am here talking with none other than the awesome Christopher Paolini.
And of course, Jennifer, you have read the audiobook version of To Sleep in a Sea of Stars. Isn't that correct?
That is absolutely correct. It was phenomenal. It was a phenomenal experience from my side. What an incredible book. It's vast. It's surprising, it's fun, it's deep, it's beautiful.
Can I use those as blurbs on the back cover?
You have my, yes, you have my hearty endorsement.
Well, and this is the Mutual Admiration Society, because I feel incredibly lucky to have had you reading the audiobook and to have you bringing it to life and bringing Kira to life, the main character, because without that, this audiobook just wouldn't be what it is. So thank you.
Thank you. It was such an honor and such a delight, man.
So I guess the question is, you know, how did you end up on this project? And it's sort of this roundabout way, because you and I met at the Supernova convention back in, what, 2012? We crossed paths?
Or 14, one of those, yeah.
Yeah, it was right after my last big book came out. And I'm a big fan of the Mass Effect series and some other work you've done. I didn't realize you did a voice for Jedi Knight 2 Jedi Academy, which I still play that game. So
really?
Yes.
Oh my God, that's fantastic.
But yeah, so we were in the process of looking for an audiobook reader for To Sleep in a Sea of Stars. And, you know, that was a difficult thing, trying to find the right voice and the right feel. And we were all sort of tearing our hair out. And then it was my dad who came along and said, no, what we need is, we need someone like Commander Shepard. We need like Jennifer Hale. And I just kind of said, well, funny you should mention that. And I think I mentioned it to Tor, and I pinged you on Twitter. It was like the next day.
And why
did you say yes? Because this is your first audiobook, right?
It is my first audiobook. I have a few friends who do audiobooks, and it's a rigorous, intense process. And I didn't have a complete understanding of it. Anything that's heavy on the engineering is not my bag. That's not what I do. And you don't want me doing that necessarily if I'm there as your talent, as your person speaking and communicating, because then my attention split. And you're not getting all of me. I just had never had time to do it. And I remembered that conversation. I remembered you saying that, and I was like, oh, that sounds like fun if that ever happens. And then you are one of the rare few who follow through. And holy cow, when you messaged me, I was like, that could be really fun. I've never done an audiobook. I don't know if I'll be any good at it, but I enjoy listening to them. I listen to a ton of nonfiction. I don't do a lot of fiction. And so I just thought, let's see what happens. I hope I don't disappoint, and I'll do my best. What are you going to do? You know?
Well, and from my point of view, you know, finding someone who could read, who had some strength to her voice and could do justice to the character in the world was really important. And that's something I think you have such a wide range, but that's something you bring to a lot of your roles, I think.
Thank you. The acting side of it. I think that was one of the more daunting balances to find for me, because when the first audiobook one does is nearly 900 pages, and there are 50 characters, finding a way to distinguish all of those characters, but without going too far into what are my typical references, which are characters in games and characters in animation and varying styles of animation. And I really relied on Callum so much. Thank you, Callum, for guidance and for, you know, when to bring it back. And I don't want to throw the reader out of the book, you know, and yet I want to honor the characters and be consistent, because my God, these characters, there's some fantastic characters in here. I mean, Sparrow is like near and dear to my heart. Her mouth. Oh my God. I love her.
So I have to ask, this is the author in me, since this is the first time we've chatted since you finished the book. So I hope you enjoyed it.
I mean, Callum will attest that there were, I think, 3 or 4 points as we were recording where I couldn't talk. I got so choked. I had to just stop. Mm-hmm. And it gets me thinking about it still. There's a moment with one of the, a character who has dealt with starvation, and the way that that's handled in the end, I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to cry. It's beautiful. It was just, it was so small and so perfect and just so moving. Yeah. And oh, there's so many moments like that. I loved the world. I loved the evolution of the character, and I loved the piece of magic that's in there. And to me, this book was, you know, at the risk of sounding super trendy and annoying, it had a very meta aspect to it, because I was like, yeah, that's how the universe works. You know, I'm reading it going, yeah, of course, that is the law of evolution of all beings in all kinds, you know, and it's played out in this novel. And I'm like, what were you channeling, Christopher? It's so great.
Aw, thanks. Well, I mean, I think we can get into a few spoilers, since presumably anyone who's listening to this or watching this has hopefully listened to or read the book.
Well, I'll be of assistance. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
But I love that you brought that up, because for me, a large reason I write these books is almost the mythical aspect, as you say, you know, those lead larger questions and deeper questions, which to me make all of the running around and shouting and fighting in the story worthwhile. And because let's face it, there's a lot of running around and shouting and fighting in the story. But if it doesn't mean anything in the end, then why write it and why read it?
Exactly.
So as the audiobook reader, what was the hardest part for you? Was there any character or aside from just the sheer length of the project?
One of the hardest parts for me, I think, was not going too far with the characters, because they were so clear and so specific. And there's a lightness in the background running, because a book like this that is so massive in its scope and so deep in its technological aspect and so huge in the weight of what's at stake, it's wonderful to find that lightness breathing through the seams, you know. And in those moments, it was a little tempting to go a little over the top. Callum was like, no, I was like, okay, sorry. It was just so fun. technically keeping all the different characters separate when they would disappear for 100 pages, or that I had my trusty voice memos like right here, and I go, hold on, and I'd scroll for pages till I'd find, oh, there's that one. Okay. They're the entropists again, you know?
Yeah.
That, and really, I think partly because it's my first audiobook, and because I don't know the experience of the listener yet and where to adjust, you know, there was a constant presence, awareness for me of, is this on target? Is this the way it needs to be? Am I doing it? And am I doing the book service? Am I doing the proper service to the book? Yeah.
Well, and I think that's the same balance that I'm trying to strike as the writer, because I like my puns, and, you know, it's fun. Actually, my agent, Simon, who's a wonderful man and a wonderful agent, he threatened me with ripping out all the puns early in the process. And I put my foot down and I said, no, puns have to stay. You know, there's a reason for it, though, because I've watched a lot of science fiction, and I'm sure you have as well. And sometimes when the stories get too dark, it actually feels unrealistic to me, to a point where, yes, the world has ended and, you know, horrible things are happening, but human beings, especially human beings who are in difficult situations, they crack jokes. You know, soldiers, paramedics, nurses, they have some of the darkest, blackest, filthiest humor you ever hear.
Yeah, they do. I heard somebody once say, who was a medical professional, that Scrubs was far more accurate than ER, you know?
I believe it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I love that. I love that scene about the newts. You know, everybody had the dialogue around the newts and everybody just took off on the newt puns. I could not even. It was fabulous.
Well, I mean, that's what people do too, isn't it?
It is. It was so much fun. Yeah, and I really, the writing, there were a few scenes where I would stop and I would, you know, because I was reading a story essentially to a person, you know, there were moments when I would sort of go a little too much into the feeling of the character. And I'm like, real human beings don't do that. And I'd redo it and back up. No, oh, they cover. We're going to cover. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the world's ending. You need a coffee. You know, that sort of a thing.
Yeah. Well, and I think the book's actually written in that style a little bit. I actually tried to keep a little bit of reserve because I think that's how people act and interact. So I feel like I owe you an apology for making you read all of the technical stuff at the back of the book.
Well, maybe some hazard pay.
Hazard pay.
That was something. My God, I had some incredible epiphanies as I was reading that, just about stuff that we won't go into now, but it was fascinating. Subliminal and superliminal space. And I certainly identified every consonant my particular physiology ever had a problem with. I have like 7 new things in my repertoire of tongue twisters to warm up. Subliminal space. And
well, it was one of those things that I felt like I really wanted to write to build out the world, but it's one of those things where, because I'm not a physicist myself, I understand it when I'm writing and I understand the big concepts even now, but to really get it on a granular level, it's like I have to sit there and think about it for days. And then as soon as I stop thinking about it, a lot of it just kind of slips away.
Well, because you're building context. You don't have context. Not like you've got a bucket and you're putting stuff in it. You're actually having to build, I'm having to build this bucket and I have maybe like 3 frames of it. So lots of water leaking out of mine, but I've got little pieces of it.
Yeah. Same. That's how I feel too. So I'm kind of curious, you know, you've done so much work in the science fiction genre. I mean, are you a big science fiction fan yourself? I know I read somewhere that you don't play video games. But I'm just kind of curious about your own interests with fiction.
I love sci-fi. I love to watch it. My reading for many years now has been nonfiction because I'm an expansion junkie. I love to expand myself, my frame of reference, my who am I? And I had forgotten, I think, until I sat down and read this book, I had forgotten that I can do that through fiction as well. You know, I had been so literal and so hands-on with it. But yeah, huge sci-fi fan. I don't actually have a lot of time to watch TV or do things or any of that stuff. But I love the sometimes operatic possibility of sci-fi. I love that it can throw our collective hat over the wall so we can have something to aspire to and somewhere to go. Some of my favorite moments in escapism, which is a way of coping with modern life, have been through sci-fi. You know, there was one episode of, have you seen The Orville?
I haven't had a chance yet. I've heard good things though.
The McFarlane show. And it's an homage to so many different aspects of sci-fi. So, you know, a couple of the super classic ones, very obviously. But the season finale of the first season of The Orville made me feel okay about everything. It took place a few hundred years in the future. And all the stuff we were so stressed about, you know, at the time of when the episode actually started in on the timeline, they time traveled to the future or something, had contact with people in the future. And everything that they thought was so horrible and it really looked pretty bad, they were like, fine, no big deal. And I was like, thank you, sci-fi. Even though we know now time travel is a myth, but yeah, thank you, Christopher.
One of the things I had to decide when working on To Sleep was like what kind of future to portray. And, you know, you don't want to go too far. I mean, unless you're like preaching an idea, you don't want to go too far one way or another and make it unrealistic to the point where humans, unless they've evolved into something new, humans are behaving in a way that we don't recognize as humans. But at the same time, I think that, you do have to make a couple of statements. You do have to make choices on what you think is going to be important or not important. One thing that I was trying to touch on, and I didn't embrace this as much as maybe another author would have, but it was still important to me, was basically a sense of weirdness. You know, because, you know, we have Asimov, we have Heinlein, we have Clark, and they were all trying to predict the future. But the one author who really got the future more than anyone was Philip K. Dick. You know, when you look at the headlines nowadays, we're living more in a Philip K. Dick universe than we were in, you know, Heinlein or Asimov. So that was something I was trying to touch on every once in a while. It's like, yes, there's big mythic epic things happening in this story, but there's some weirdness around the corners too. And that's because humans are weird.
I loved that. You know, that's a really interesting question. Like, I'm curious about your process as a writer. How do you go from an idea to a project this massive, to something as giant as To Sleep in a Sea of Stars? How do you do that?
Years, blood, sweat, and tears, and years, tears and years. That's kind of the answer. I think the first thing is you have to have a reason to write. You know, in my case, it was two things. It was literally the scene where Kira finds, she finds the suit originally, and it flows over her body and then later emerges. And then when she's drifting off at the end of the book, and literally that's all I had to start with, those two scenes. And I'm not exaggerating when I say every single word in the book, every character, everything else in the book was literally written to support that final scene and that first scene. Because when I thought of that final scene, I felt it. And if I felt it, I thought, you know, if I do my job right, I can create that feeling in the audience, in the reader. And that's the feeling I want to convey. And then all the work is simply figuring out the themes, figuring out the characters, you know, how it all ties together to build to that transcendent moment. How did you approach, you know, voicing an alien that communicates with via scent? And we had some conversations about this.
I called the writer. And I said, what am I supposed to do with this? And he was very helpful.
Oh.
No, I liked, it really was that conversation with you when I reached mm-hmm. out and you were gracious enough to respond. And that was really helpful. The formality of it, the fact that it wasn't native to the human speaker or to the Renawi speaker, the jellies, that they both were formal in where they met in the middle. Like whenever I was Kira speaking to the jellies, mm-hmm. she was also speaking in that more formal tone because mm-hmm. she was speaking them in the translation zone. Right.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I hope that's okay. I'm like, uh-oh, that look on his face, was that okay or not okay?
Yeah, of course it, yeah.
And it was placement, really. It was arriving at a place where they speak from, where it's about where it's placed in the mouth, and it's not a lot of there's not a lot of body in it. It's simply mm-hmm. a communication device, but there's a personality behind it as well. Mm-hmm. And like Lafette's journey in the book is, you know, briefly as we visit with that, it was a journey, and Lafette became very self-important. It, you know, the second time you see Lafette, I was like, okay, this is Lafette now.
That's right. Well, that's awesome. And I, you know, as an author, I love that you took so much care with the characters, that you were willing to reach out and talk about this, because that's not always the case. I mean, I've been very fortunate with Gerard Doyle, who read my previous novels. But I know talking with some other authors, you know, that sometimes that, the experience is less than pleasant. So it was really lovely to work with you on that. And I have to tell you, when I got the samples of your reading, when I first heard a chunk of your reading from a couple different places in the book, but when I heard that, it was one of the strangest experiences for me, because I've been living with this book for so long. I mean, it's over 7 years I worked on it, and I got the original idea all the way back in 2006, 2007. So long time. And I was sitting there and I was hearing you read the book. And even though I know you hadn't worked into the story yet completely, it was surreal. And especially because I am familiar with your voice from various games. And it was wonderful too, because it was coming to life and it was outside of me instead of just being stuck up in my head, which is where it was for so long. And I'm actually very much looking forward to listening to the whole audiobook. Like, you couldn't pay me to read the book on paper at this point, but I want to listen. I'm going to be listening to the whole audiobook once I get it.
Do you listen to audiobooks, or do you mostly ingest your stuff through the written page?
I listen to audiobooks on occasion. The problem for me is that I read so fast that audiobooks can sometimes slow me down, but I really love listening to them when I'm walking. So
I listen to them on like 1.25, like a little faster than the written.
That's true. That's true. But I always feel like that doesn't do justice to the performance of the reader. So, but now I listen to the audiobook for one of my favorite fantasy novels, which is The Worm Ouroboros by E.R. Edison, which is a pre-Tolkien fantasy written in faux Jacobian English. It's just like all this wonderful linguistic experience. And so that was a wonderful audiobook I listened to not long ago. So out of curiosity, on a technical level, how did you protect your voice when reading something that's 800-900 pages long? Because I know I had to read the afterword. I mean, I didn't have to, but I enjoyed reading it, recording it. And that was just a couple of pages, and I was already starting to wear out my voice by then.
Yeah. You know, I've been using my voice for so many years that really what fatigues faster than my voice are my eyes. Mm. Such concentrated reading. And I actually have dyslexia and astigmatism. So I would flip words and I would pull a word from the sentence below up to the sentence that is. And I actually never, when I was a kid, you know, nobody cared. They're like, just get your stuff done, you know, whatever, go outside, you know, okay. And I never realized I was dyslexic until computers really, I had to do a lot of typing, and I found myself putting the D's on the right and the J's on the left and the E's and the I's would get flipped. And I was like, what? And I was like, that's exactly backwards, huh? And then people started talking about dyslexia. And I was like, oh, and if I get really stressed or tired, I will write words out of sequence. Because my brain moves really fast in my hand. It's like, keep up. You know? Sorry, hand, I love you. Thank you. But so those really become issues before my voice does. I mean, there were times, and actually probably my muscles in here for enunciation, I would notice sometimes an R or a, you know, like there's weird little muscles like right in here that form like R's, and right here we'd get like, I'd like, huh, that seems to be getting weak. And I'd be like, okay, let's go. You know? But I mean, I started singing in clubs when I was 15, in rock clubs, in a band, sound man who was in love with miking the drum, even if we were playing in a closet. So I had to have some power and some machinery underneath me since I was 15. And I watched the singers in town. There was one particular gig where every singer lost their voice because it was 6 hours a night and it's 6 days and it started at 10 p.m. And I was like 16, a lot of sixes in there. So I went to a classical singing teacher who taught me opera technique. And I have kind of a freakishly large rib cage. And I swear, I think that's part of it, is I've been just working these muscles since then. And I still have a teacher that I go to, shout out to Bill Haller. He teaches like a Broadway belt technique. And every now and then, if I need a check-in, I was recording some songs last fall. And there was one that I wrote, and I wanted to do an octave harmony. And I'm like, oh my God, this sounds horrible. So I ran back to Bill. I'm like, Bill, he's like, remember this, remember that? I'm like, ah, thank you. And so, I mean, I stay in shape. This is my instrument. It's like you playing with words for hours and hours and hours. And, you know, that machinery is just second nature for you. I think I've done this my whole life. So the machinery is largely second nature. And if I'm getting tired, I go a different place than you will. You know, if you're getting tired, you're like, oh, is it okay? If I'm getting tired, I'm like, oh, drop the ball. Okay, ribs out, you know, jaw strong, muscles strong, oxygen, and I'll tighten all through my whole entire upper torso will be like a brick support system for this. Technique, I guess. Is there anything that you want people to know about this story that we haven't touched on? That's not in the words, that's not in the book. Anything you want people to know?
There are a lot of things that will probably become clear with some more future books that sort of tie into this one, because there are layers upon layers here. But I think the biggest one is, for me, this book is a dream. You know, the reason I wrote it, the reason I had that image of Kira drifting off into the darkness, it was a feeling like a dream. And writing it was in some ways like a dream. And I hope that, you know, it is not a perfect work. No work is, but for all its flaws and for all its successes, that ultimately that's what people will take away from this, is that those feelings and that sense of awe and wonder and hope.
Mm. Beautiful. That's how I felt.
I was lucky to have such a good reader.
I hope you like it. No, I really...
I know I do.
I loved it. It was, what a great experience. And I'd do it again in a hot second. It was so cool.
Well, I'll be calling you up when I've got a sequel about Kira.
In.
This is Jennifer Hale. Thank you for listening to Sleep in a Sea of Stars. Recorded by Sal Baroni. Edited by Patrick Smith Audio. Original music by Malta Wiegman. Executive producer Callum Plews. Text copyright 2020 by Christopher Paolini. The Immense Journey, an imaginative naturalist, explores the mystery of man and nature. Text copyright 1946 by Lauren Isley. Used by permission of the University of Pennsylvania. Production copyright 2020 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved. Thanks for listening.